What Witch, This, That, or the Other? From Bonnaroo to Coachella, traversing the music festival landscape can be tricky. That's where we come in with high fives for everyone. The What Podcast with Brad Barry, Lord Taco, dedicated to exploring the entire festival scene.
Brad has worked in the radio industry for more than 20 years and currently lives in Brooklyn, where he is program director for three stations, including one in New York, one in Detroit, and one in Miami.
Barry's been a reporter for the Chattanooga Times Free Press, covering all aspects of the entertainment industry since 1987. That's before you were born.
Lord Taco, the smart guy who makes these podcasts on our website at thewhatpodcast.com work, also really good at identifying babies, loves blue-haired moms, PBR, and his beautiful Volkswagen bus.
We all fell in love with the Bonnaroo Festival years ago, not only because of the amazing bands that play there every year, but also because of the incredible community spirit that has developed around it. Radiate positivity.
And we really like talking about the inside baseball stuff when it comes to putting on a huge music festival. So join us.
You can hear the What Podcast on the Consequence Podcast Network or anywhere you find your favorite podcasts.
Hey pod people, Engineer Adam here, jumping in for a quick second to let you know about the brand new all-in-one platform for all of you creative podcasters out there. Anchor makes it easier than ever to make a podcast. It's free to use and has all the creation tools you need to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer. Plus, Anchor will get your podcast set up on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, wherever podcasts are found. Even better, Anchor helps you connect with sponsors, even if you're just starting out. It's the perfect choice for podcasters, so make sure to check it out. Download the free Anchor app or go to anchor.fm to get started. That's anchor.fm. Back to the show.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Hello, pod people! Leo Phillips here with another edition of This Must Be The Gig, your little backstage pass to the world of live music. If you're new here, every single week I bring you fascinating conversations from the beating heart of the performance scene with some of the most exciting names in this gigantic, big, spongy globe. We talk passion, we talk first concerts, insights into the creative mind during this truly unusual time, and everything in the juicy center. This week, I am beyond delighted to share a conversation with the incredible, the powerful Jenny Beth.
There's always that fear that the world's going to forget about you.
I have been very lucky to cover Jenny Beth many times over the years as the vocalist of the almighty post-punk band Savages. I can remember the shove of the crowd running to the stage when she came on. It was the most exhilarating performance I've ever shot. It was one of the first shows I shot many, many years ago at the Guess Who Festival, which I've spoken about so many times. And there was one moment which I remember vividly when she prompted a dude that was kind of hanging over the front of the stage and she pulled him up on stage. He kind of made a little bit of a Jesus arm stretched out wide across the stage reach, and she pushed him into the crowd and he flew. It was remarkable. And there really are incredibly few performers with that kind of intensity and energy. And seeing her walk across the outstretched hands of fans at the front of the crowd is just one of the biggest wow moments I think I've ever experienced. And that energy has not been contained only in Savages, as Jenny has also acted, hosted radio and TV shows. And she also has an upcoming book about sexual liberation and transgression, which was produced with her partner, Johnny Hostile. So this month, Jenny released her first album under her own name. It's called To Love Is To Live. And rather than a solo album, she has dubbed it a personal album. Thanks in part to her collaborative process with artists such as the XX's Romy Madley Croft and producer Flood. The album To Love Is To Live is such a triumph, and Jenny's voice honed to an incredibly fine point that she wields with curiosity and passion. In this chat, I spoke with Jenny about the origins of the album, her earliest performance experiences, and so much more. So let us not be delayed. This is me and Jenny. Please take care of yourselves and enjoy.
I'm the man. This is who I am.
I did my first show this weekend for the BBC, and you can watch it online if you're curious to see it.
Yeah.
It was at the Roundhouse in London.
How was that?
It was great. It was absolutely, you know, beyond. Yeah, I loved it.
And have you performed any of those songs before the show?
No, it was the first time. It was the first time. When I started making this record, To Love Is To Live, I consciously avoided thinking of the stage first, because I wanted to do things differently from what I had done before. And obviously with Savages, it was all about the stage. The records came second, you know. And I really wanted to make a record first and foremost. So I forced myself to stop thinking about the musical representation of the songs on stage and concentrated on making an album. And so last August I started to... with Johnny Hostile, we started to think about, you know, who was going to be on stage with us and how we're going to bring those songs to the stage. And so it's been a lot of work and a lot of learning new techniques as well. And we wanted to up our game a bit in the way we had done things before. And it was very interesting, and we learned a lot through that process. And so the last show, the first show was... last weekend, and I only felt like I'd never left the stage. It felt very natural and very very rewarding and fun as well.
When a performance is effective, like, what makes it work for you? Obviously everybody has a different discipline and a different way to approach it, but why is it effective, and why do you walk off stage? And how do you walk off stage going like, okay, I got what I needed from that? What are the things that you actually need?
I tend to not plan in advance too much. I just never know if I'm going to go to the crowd or try to keep it, you know, in the moment. I think the thing I try to tell myself before going on is do not think, you know, place for thinking. So, and I just want to let the music do the job, you know, and transform me and put me in a different place. What I love about, you know, stage is that it's a moment where you give your complete attention to something, and there's no observer at all, you know, and And that state of attention, I think, is total energy, and that total energy is a form of intelligence in itself, you know. Maybe even a higher form of intelligence.
I love that. Because also, you know, improvising on stage is one thing, but also just like feeling into oneself is also a really tough skill to harness when sometimes being in control as a creative is really important. So that's interesting. Mm. If you give, you know, kind of not giving up, but surrendering in that moment, it also takes a lot of preparation. I don't know if that makes sense.
Exactly. That's why preparation is the key. I think, you know, the saying slow preparation, fast execution. I think it's exactly that. You work so hard before and to make everything the way you want it to be. But when it comes to time to perform, then everything, all that work pays off and it's been done, and you can just enjoy the moment, you know.
I think what's interesting, what you said earlier about obviously having that consideration of creating an album not based on the outcome of, okay, I'm going to be performing this like you did with Savages. You obviously phrased it much better than I am doing now, but I think that that's quite an interesting point, in that I wonder now what change then in the subjects that you decided to tackle, or did that not come into consideration? What was the thing that shifted when you weren't thinking about the stage during the creation of this record?
I think it's because if I was going to think of the stage, I was going to be tied up to one sound and maybe try to recreate what I had done before. After Savage's second record, I collaborated with Gorillaz, and then I did some recordings with Breedy of Massive Attack, which never came out, not yet anyway. But that opened my mind about how my voice could work, my persona, let's say, could work in different types of music, and it just got me curious, you know, about exploring different sounds and opening up. So you know, during the process of making the album, I just consciously tried to keep myself in the unknown, and not knowing what I was doing. And if I would hear sound or, you know, similar to what I had heard myself before, I would try to get rid of it, and I would try to keep things that I didn't know what they were. So it was just my only strategy, you know. I think in the past I would start with a goal and something I really want to achieve, and I work hard to achieve it. And for this record, I didn't start with a, you know, a preconception of or an idea. I tried to work with instinct and, you know, start with an impulsion, a feeling, an experience, but not start with a postulo, an idea.
And obviously that's liberating in a sense, but it's also more so like, I'm sure that's really, it's quite exciting also for you to do something, because anything new, I can imagine, feels quite recharged. You know, like when you're doing something new, that's quite, even if it's tough, it's something new. So it gets you out of that like usual funk of, okay, I'm trying to repeat, and then I might not be able to.
Yeah, I enjoy that feeling of starting from scratch. I think it's something I've done several times in my life, and I love working against fear, you know, and feeling that feeling of, you know, discomfort that it creates. It's not very. It's not comfortable, but it feels you feel alive, you know.
I like how you phrase, like, obviously working against it, because I think what's so interesting is always an artist's or just a human's relationship to fear in terms of sharing your work, in terms of being, you know, entwined in your work. So that's quite interesting, especially because your collaborative work style, of course, with the band, you're one persona, and then going into things that are kind of servicing yourself, it's another. So every time that fear came up, what did you just have to work through it, or do you find that it just had a different face? You know, that the normal fear wasn't really there because you were kind of, you know, into your own thing. How did you push through that fear then?
Well, you know, I like working with fear. I think fear is part of the process. I think fear is shouldn't be really listened to sometimes. There are certain feelings like that which are transient and don't define who we are, but we can't help feeling them, like jealousy or, you know, fear. And I think there are feelings that I don't want to be defined by them, because if you go behind, if you work despite of fear, you're gonna be more generous towards yourself, because it's such an effort. You're doing something so from which you cannot come back. And I think once you're in that state, then you become more aware and a little bit more alert and maybe more generous and more giving. And so I think creatively you can hear it and you can hear it in the work, you know. But I mean, that's what you call sort of freedom in a way, but freedom doesn't come for free. So you're always going to have to pay a price, you know, for the challenging things. And conquering the fear is it's what we love in people that we call heroes, you know, my heroes, or, you know, and they are, that's why I wanted to write a song about heroes. And I felt that people who, you know, who despite their conditioning, their education, the context, in which they are, they manage to conquer their fears, and despite all the suffering that comes with it, you know. So that's what a hero is, isn't it? So I found that very inspiring. Unfortunately, heroes are most of the time killed.
Right.
Because they don't. They remind us how much we've lived so timidly.
Yeah.
And so we don't really like that.
Or often praised when they have passed, because then you look back at like the breadth of their work, and then you get to have that perspective, right? And it's too late. So what sort of fear then did you push past for this? What were the things? I know it's hard to quantify so simply, but was there anything that kind of surprised you about this process that you really didn't expect?
I think I had to accept to show parts of myself, which are also part of you know, what it is to be human, and which I'm ashamed of and not very proud of, and I wanted to bring that forward into the work and make it the centerpiece of the work, and then try to start from there, but start from the place the ideas and the thoughts I'm most ashamed of, you know, because that's what I love in novels or films, or, you know, when you have characters that are flown and they're not perfect, and explore, you know, that evil side and see what that means when you put the mask on. And because I always feel a bit uncomfortable when I feel like there's a line that's drawn on the ground and I'm standing on the right side of the fence. I always feel very uncomfortable artistically anyway. So I think a lot of the record is me going through those sort of personas and doing bad things together, because I think living is accepting to be wrong.
I feel like that sounds very clear for you, but I'm kind of intrigued by that clarity. A lot of people just get stopped, right, when they are going to be showing another version of themselves, which is why, like, art is so vulnerable in any respect, whether it's, you know, through painting or performance.
Mm.
Like, do you feel like you were supported very well enough, considering, you know, you have some amazing collaborators on this record as well. Like, there's quite unique, you know, everyone from obviously Flood to Joe from Idols, who's just such a wonderful person. And do you feel like that assisted in a way to allow you to feel a little bit more comfy with putting those, that version of yourself out there?
Yeah, probably. I feel everyone who's taken part in the record has been at some point or another owned it completely, you know, and taken more than partnership, more like, you know, it was their record for a while, and I wanted that to happen. I allowed them to take ownership, you know, of the record during the process, because I feel that's what's beautiful about collaborations, when you can see someone's talent just really take the space, you know, in your own space. And then the people I worked with were 100% believing into the record, and maybe that, you're right, maybe that helped me to spread my wings a bit, and to just be, it was a very high level of trust, you know.
Yeah.
The work. So, I mean, the first collaborator, obviously, is Johnny Hostein, who I've been working with for 15 years.
Exactly, so. Yeah.
And our relationship has had to evolve for this record, and our work relationship. And that doesn't go without challenges, but that's what we're good at. That's what we love doing. So try to break our habits and try to do things differently. And because we really didn't want to repeat ourselves or the way we had done things in the past. And I needed time, and I allowed time to be in, you know, to be one of the main ingredients, let's say, of the process, because I felt that before I always done record in a rush, and this was going to be something that I wanted to take time with and to explore and have do a lot of research, musical research, but also lyrics, lyric writing, doing some sessions with Romy Madley Croft from the XX, who was a really good friend of mine, but who really took on board this sort of a process together of meeting up and meet her. I'll travel to meet her in Berlin or to wherever she was touring, and or in London or in Las Vegas, I remember once, and just sitting down in the hotel room for a whole day and just writing together, and all that is, it's not that, maybe I don't know, 10% of what we've done made it to the record, but it was more about exploring new methods of working and learning from someone else who comes from a different, you know, background. And we have a lot in common musically, like we love a lot of similar things, but also we come from different horizons. So I felt it was, I don't know, I love the idea of learning new things and not trying to conclude too soon or to finalize things too soon, but just allow a period of time when it was just research, you know. And
I think that time is such a fascinating concept in relation to a creative, right? Like, people don't get, it's not that you don't get given enough time, but I don't think you demand enough of it. Not you, but one. Because the time it takes, I always feel like people, like when people say, oh, they write so quickly, I'm like, I write so slowly. I write and backspace. I go out for a walk. I come back. It's like my process is so scrambled and different depending on what I'm writing. And I feel like I'm always struggling with the concept, like how to stretch and expand that sense of time around something. Yeah. Because I think, and that's even weirdly maybe a little bit philosophizing too much, but philosophy behind giving time to oneself and others is something that we just don't feel anymore. Like, I feel panicked a lot and things like that. Yeah. And so hearing you say that you got that time and you gave it to yourself is such a wonderful idea.
Yeah, and I felt that I'd never really done a record like this and allow moments where I wouldn't listen to it for a few weeks, you know, and and have a different perspective. I wanted to shift perspectives and make sure it was the best it could be. I think it's very good that I did that, because after a year of work, I thought I had the record and it was done. And then I listened back. I remember after a few weeks, and it was so clear it wasn't ready. And but I had the feeling that it was done. But so I needed more time. And but you need to be very strong, because you want to get out there, you want to release the music, you want people to hear it, but at the same time you don't really want to go there if you're not ready, if you're not sure what you have to say. And also there's always that fear that the world's going to forget about you. But I knew that music, so I was like, okay, I've heard this before, I know it's not true, so I'm gonna trust myself and just live my life and work, because I've worked a lot. Like, although you're not public and you're not out there,
but you also, you were acting and performing, of course, in a few films as well.
Yeah.
And you also, are releasing a book coming up as well, which, yeah, I can't wait to talk about as in addition to this. Do you feel like they helped you in writing this album, or are they completely separate disciplines?
They are different disciplines. I also started working on a TV show a year ago.
Oh.
Show which has just started being broadcasted this year.
Oh, wow.
And I think my hero for that is Henry Rollins. You can feel that drive in him of trying new things and having these experiences. I think you learn about yourself in a different way through these different experiences. And maybe, yes, they are helpful for the record in some ways, but they're more helpful in knowing yourself, The record, in a way, lyrically, I wrote pretty quickly all the lyrics. Maybe in 6 months or a year, I had everything I wanted to say. And then it was about working the music. And I couldn't really write any more lyrics after that. I thought, sick of writing lyrics.
Yeah.
And so in between recording sessions of To Love Is To Live, I started writing a book of short stories about sexuality and erotica. It was interesting because I felt that lyric writing is always something you can do in passing, mm-hmm. In the bus or in the car, or I don't know, traveling especially, I think it's good,
right.
Or hearing someone say something in the street or on TV, or it's this sort of patchwork of things that suddenly come to you, or things you read, articles. Like one song on the record I wrote after reading articles about people who have to go on rehab for electronics, for their phone. And,
the digital kind of...
Digital rehab,
God, do we all need that? Yeah.
How the digital world would start changing our bodies and our mind, and people would go blind and their brain would be atrophied and they'd feel like they can't have any clear thinking anymore. But then for the book writing, I felt it was very hard to do it on the go. Like when you write a book, it's more you sitting at a desk for hours. It's a very different process, and you have to be very concentrated and very focused and also very alone, because you don't want any distractions while you start writing pages and pages. So I started to travel on my own. So I went to different cities and I just settled there for a while and just have my routine in the city, have my breakfast in a local cafe, and then go back home and work for 5 hours.
Oh my gosh.
And then go for my late dinner and then just walk around in the city. It just felt different and very physical, even though I was just sitting at a desk.
Yeah, well, there's movement there as well, like the fluidity that you feel when you are writing lyrics on a bus or a plane or backstage or wherever. You can recreate that almost sitting in one spot, but that's with your brain, because you're doing these mental... aerobics almost, trying to figure out what words fit together, what ideas fit together. I don't know if this is a weird question, but how important are your surroundings when you are in that creative mode, like especially if you're traveling around.
Yeah, very important. I think I always want to have my desk in front of a big window.
Yeah.
So I always try to find places where there's a massive view. So it's a big, big desk and books and my notebooks and my computer and water, coffee.
Yes.
And I really love the discipline of writing a book. It's you know, it's like a ritual almost, and to shut down the world really and concentrate on finishing it.
Pause the podcast.
It's time to step away from the conversation with Jenny Beth ever so briefly to share a special segment. We typically like to share our favorite live show or live stream of the week, but we want to continue putting a spotlight where it's most needed right now and instead highlight an organization we think you should contribute to. This week, we're highlighting Chicago EAT, Chicago Equity and Transformation. The organization was founded and established for and by post-incarcerated and marginalized Black people in Chicago, and it strives to uplift the faces, voices, and power of the vast disenfranchised and excluded Black workforce in Chicago. To support those working without the legal protections of formal employment, you can go to eatchicago.org, that's eatchicago.org, and contribute to their campaign. It's an incredible organization. We really would love if you joined us in support. If you would like to learn more about that organization or many others that you can contribute to, head to our Google Doc of shared resources and reading material. That link will always be in the episode description and also on our social media. And also feel free to reach out to us at thismustbethegig@gmail.com in order to share other organizations you think we should know about and share with everyone that's listening. But for now, back to Lior and Jenny. Enjoy!
Writing about sexuality, you need to tap into some sort of imagination, of course, which again you use and utilize for lyric writing and songwriting and also performing, like that imagination. I wonder if that imagination is similar for writing about sex and sexuality as it is for music, because both whirl very vividly. Like those two worlds, I feel like, are in that imaginary fantasy world. Even if you're writing about things that are real or not.
Yeah, exactly. That's why at the time I was reading a lot of Borges, the writer, and I was really interested in that sort of magical realism style. And I love that different dimensions of realism. And I felt that for sexuality and especially fantasies, it was great to be able to get off route, you know, and to have that freedom and bring some magic into it. And obviously the land of imagination is the best place for sexual expression. And I think we should use our mind more and, you know, and to have this sort of, initiative, you know, with sexuality. To instigate, connect more our imagination with sexuality, I think is important.
Well, then it allows you to be in a space where you are experiencing something, whether it's on your own or with a partner, or with multiple partners, whatever your preference, of course.
Yeah.
Then you're allowing yourself, you're like giving yourself permission then to imagine that any outcome is possible, as opposed to seeing yourself as this like boxed in being. You know what I mean? Like I feel like I used to write about sex a lot when I first started writing. And I feel like weirdly when I started writing about music, it was, I feel like I was tapping into the same brain, because way that I listen to music is really similar to the way that I think about sex, because there is that endless possibility. Like nothing, even if you sit and say, Lior, I know the themes of this album, I know what I was singing, this is what it's about, it's still going to mean something different to every single one. So every single person that, you know, it touches, because that's the ability of art and storytelling, right?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I like what you're saying about writing about music and writing about sexuality being similar. I don't write about music, so But I like that you shared that. I think that's very interesting. I never thought about it that way before.
I don't think I have either. But listening to you speak about it in a way where there's so many limitations to ways of describing one's experience, whether that's sexuality or whether that's politics or whether that's, you know, relationships, fear, anxiety, anything, love. And there's always that like weird cap of like, well, if you do it this way, you need to do it that way forever. And I think like approaching something with almost like a childlike imagination is so crucial for you, not only for yourself, but also for the reader or the person who's going to, you know, like you can almost hear that on the album. Like I feel when you get to the song A Place Above with, you've got Cillian Murphy, I know it's like a minute long, but that felt almost cinematic to me in a way of like, I feel like I'm watching a movie. I don't know if that makes sense. Like I felt like I was taken to another place in your album in that moment.
Imagination plays a very important role in the change of humanity. That's, I think sometimes telling stories is more powerful than writing essays, because it's, you know, the same way like a dream can change your perception. Even reality as we know it, society as we know it, is a fiction, you know. It's got its own lexicology, its own myths, its own heroes. So the society functions under the secret understanding of the codes of that fiction. So in a way, you can't really interact or fight that fiction with ideas. You have to fight it with fiction. And fiction doesn't mean that it don't exist, you know, but sometimes I feel it's more powerful to tell a story than trying to consciously try to break down, you know, all the elements of society and like, you know, the way that activism would do, or you know,
exactly.
Sometimes the imagination can be more powerful. But the writing about sexuality for me was also important because I still feel that love is too much defined by the ancestral codes of romanticism, because we look at relationships with a sort of hope of normality, and we want to be reassured, we want to confine our feelings to what we are told they should be. And I think we think that what relationship requires and what makes them valuable, we think we know what they require and what makes them valuable, but we don't imagine that love is something we can learn.
No.
And so we fall in love then, and we're unhappy. The problem I have with romanticism is that it generates so much frustration, and we're disappointed constantly that reality, our reality, disagrees with the idea of love that we've been made to accept as the only alternative. So writing about sexuality and different kinds of sexuality was for me a way to suggest new alternatives for those who don't necessarily find that the accepted modes of loving, like monogamy, family, are necessarily everything they want in their life. And again, no judgment if it's not the case. Like it's not. It's everybody's different, and also everybody is different in their lifetime. You might need different things depending on your age and what's happening in your life. I wanted to bring forward the idea that love is not a fixed image that one can adjust to or resemble. You know, love is movable, it's changeable, it's and it differs with time and with each individual, I suppose. So it's sort of my post-romantic sort of story.
But I love that, because I think a lot of people will be inspired by that notion, because seeing something as the static box, like amidst a storm, it's very hard for that box to survive, right? So if you do have the static idea of how things are meant to be, this unchangeable thing, how are you ever meant to get... it's like somebody saying, you know, my partner isn't compromising, or my work relationships, they're not listening to me. It's like you also need to have that sense of boundlessness almost in yourself. You know, you mentioned the word judgment. You're put in this weird position where you are idolized, but also expected, you know, the things are expected of you.
Mm.
But then you also can create, and then you get to do this. So there's so many different sides of it. You almost have to be as boundless as that as well, which I think is fascinating. But going from that idea of doing these things that you really love to do and exploring this version of yourself, now that the record is done, with the performative side, we started chatting in the beginning of this conversation about the performance that you just did. Do you find that you're approaching performance in that way as well now? Like you're opening up to things that, you know, anything can happen in that moment.
We were talking about change. I think change is something that happens very intimately, you know, in the intimacy of yourself, but it's not something you can decide. You can't just wake up and be like, oh, okay, I'm going to change. I think, yeah, live performance is going to be my next sort of creative output, I'd say, I suppose. I started writing a new ideas for a new book, and so I think those things are going to, you know, come, yeah. Or another film soundtrack, or, you know, things like that that are going to come, yeah.
I could even hear that on the record, though, even with, like, you know, the French countryside and The Rooms, especially. That song also stuck out in terms of, like, that filmic quality to it.
Yeah.
But do you remember the first concert that you ever saw when you were either a child or an adult, like the first live performance that you ever experienced? Do you remember that?
Yeah, I think there were two major ones. I was maybe 13 or something. We walked past a venue, a famous venue in Paris called Olympia, and we saw that my mum's favorite singer was performing, and so they bought tickets, and we went that evening, so it was kind of an improvised sort of thing. I remember seeing the relationship that my mum would have with the gig, and the way that, because she loved the gig, you know, the song so much, and that she felt so happy, so transported by it. And I felt it was very touching, you know, and almost, I felt almost rude to witness it. It felt almost like, you know, it was like her thing, and
so
it was
private.
Very sensual. And I could sense her whole body was experiencing this moment. And I felt it was very intimate, you know, and I had never really seen my mother in that situation, that context. It's almost like she was in love with him, and so it was with my dad being next to her, and I felt it was this sort of forbidden thing, transgressing, you know, something very excited about. Second show was when I was probably 15 or something, and I was a massive fan of the Yeah Yeah Yeahs, and they hadn't released their first record yet. It was just the first EP, and they came to perform in Paris. So I took the train with my friend, my best friend. We took a train from the city where I was born, and we ran to the show because we were late. And I remember Karen O taking about 15 to 20 minutes before she would come on stage while the band was working for her. And I know Nick Zinner is a good friend, and I talked to him about that show, how incredible that was for me. Like, I had never seen someone being so free, you know, on stage. And I think when she finally arrived, she sort of rolled against the wall behind the curtain or something, and started the song from there. And I don't know, it was such so freeing and exciting. I loved it.
I think she's one of the only people that can make me, like, do everything whilst laugh and cry and scream.
Yeah.
I love the Yeah Yeahs so much. And it's so amazing that you've told me this experience, because I can't even imagine seeing them at 15 and watching an artist like that just take over.
It's completely life-saving. Yeah.
Because also she, it's not that she only knows who she is, but it's this like sense of animalistic, like the way that she performs is so fluid. Yeah. It's kind of like everything we've been speaking about. She's such a great example of that. I mean, there's so many wonderful performers out there, which I kind of reminded you of an experience I had with watching you, which I honestly feel like watching you is very similar to her, not the same at all. But that sense of like, there's almost a weird sense of urgency in the performance. Yeah. Like you can't do anything other than that in that moment.
She's been very influential for me. And watching that show, I think, was confirmed to me that I just wanted to do that, you know.
Obviously, in terms of like sobriety, are you still, because I know reading many years ago, I remember reading some things that you know, went sober a few years ago. And so are you still sober now?
Yes, I am, yeah.
What was the year that you went sober?
I'm not very good in math, but it was 6 years and a half ago.
Okay.
Well, it was especially because I was a touring artist and that, because alcohol is so available all the time, and I started really to find, you know, have symptoms of depression and of tiredness, you know, and also the trigger for me was when I lost my voice. You know, partying, alcohol and tiredness. And I went to see a specialist doctor for the voice. Yeah, I remember people were telling me he was Adele's doctor, you know, for her voice. He's like a big master, like this guru voice. Yeah. So I went to see him and he told me, you know, they gave me re-education lessons for the voice, but also he said you should stop. You've got 3 weeks before the next tour, so you should stop drinking tea, coffee, and alcohol, and only drink hot water. And then there was a list of ingredients I wasn't allowed to eat. And so I did it because I thought it was my instrument. You know, I can't, if I can't sing, I can't live, you know. So it was not hard for me to do it. I was very highly motivated. So, and then when we went back on tour at the time, it was actually in Australia, I remember, for Laneway's tour. I had never sung so easily, so I have felt in control, and then also I felt that alcohol had been numbing my fears of, you know, stage fright and all that, but also it had been numbing my happiness and my emotions with the music and my connection to the crowd, and so suddenly it was like a veil was gone, and I could hear people clapping. I think I couldn't hear them before.
Because it's you're right. It's like a veil. Like when you get sober, there's a total veil, like lifted. Yeah. You almost feel like, I don't know, for me, it's been like 8 years or something as well. I feel like it's been kind of similar timing.
Yeah.
And it felt like my skin was like raw. You know, like when like I couldn't speak to people the same way, not in a bad way. Yeah. I just was like more intentional with my words and.
Yeah, absolutely. More mindful of others. And,
yes. And yourself. Yeah.
And yourself. Yeah.
But so then you went on to perform more and more. So did you kind of get a new sense of like, oh, so this is really who I am? Or did you just get a sense of like, this is just the next phase?
I think the first show was nervous, but after the first two shows, I felt I'm never drinking again. Like. Yeah.
Well, because it's like, it is like a drug, ironically.
Exactly. I was high on reality, you know?
Oh, I love that.
and as I said, like people's cheering and suddenly I could hear them, and I remember crying because I realized how much people loved it and how much love I was receiving from them. So, and still do today. I would never drink before going on stage. I haven't drank ever since. But for me, it would be like, why would I want to stop myself from feeling so high on music and you know. It's such a gift.
And especially in that moment that you, live performance is all about that moment that is, you cannot capture it, even if you do film it on your phone or record it, you know, to release an album, you can never get that moment back. So not being available or allowing yourself to be available in that moment is kind of...
Everything, you can't really get anything back, can you? And so might as well be in the moment. I mean, it's the same for sex. I mean, I think the drugs and the alcohol are very, it's quite dangerous even to be so, have such an altered conscious with sexuality, because I think you need to be there and you need to make sure that you do something you really want to do and you do it, you know. It's nice for you need to find a way to disinhibit yourself, but I do think that it's so much better without alcohol.
Oh God, I know. I agree. I'm certainly not one of those people who are like never drink again, but I'm certainly definitely sure. of the I feel like everything in my life, it was like, you know, in The Wizard of Oz when everything goes from black and white into color, like I felt like it was my life. Like everything just became, I could see everything for the first time, even if it was scary, like the color, you know, even if it was frightening. And it was, and it still is. It's not easy to stay sober, especially with what's going on in this world right now. My God. But it is easy to make that decision when you know how good it can potentially be. But so on Human, the song, when you say I'm naked all the time, is that referencing the feeling of being, I don't know if I can segue into that, but does that reference feeling like you are exposed, but obviously in a way that you're not hiding anything?
Yeah, it's pretty much how I felt all the way from making this record.
Yeah.
Voluntarily, like I wanted to feel, you know, on the edge and feel raw and vulnerable and to not shy away from the experiences and the doubts and the self-doubts and not try to hide them away or wear a mask of, you know.
I could probably talk to you forever, so I don't want to take up too much of your time. But going into the next phase of this, and now obviously with touring and everything kind of up in the air, because of, you know, the world and this horrible virus that's going around. Do you feel, when you feel kind of stuck about an idea or about, you know, something that you're considering that might be quite scary, what is the advice that you've been given or advice that you kind of give yourself to push through?
I think feeling naked all the time is part of it. And it's about embracing, I think, that discomfort. But I think, you know, I have moments of blankness where I can't really write anything and I don't know, or everything I write feels really bad. And so I think they're just part of, you know, every artist to have moments where it's a block, you know, and you can't get anything that feels good enough. I think everybody goes through that. So they're part of the process. And sometimes they last hours, sometimes weeks, sometimes years for different artists. And they're just part of it. And what they mean, I think, is that you are still searching, that you haven't found something yet, but you're still searching. And I always think of, you know, the scientists who spend a lifetime trying to find a cure for a virus, for example. You know, I try to keep myself in that mindset of, you know, an explorer in a way that artists are. And I think it's just trying to never give up. And even if you think what you're writing is bad, you should still write and you should still keep notes and keep pushing. And if you think it's bad what you're writing, you shouldn't read back straight away. Maybe allow some time in between, because we're different people, you know. Every week we have different perspectives on things. So what you think is bad one week, you might think it's actually kind of interesting the week after. And I don't know. I mean, it's just, it's a muscle. Creativity is a muscle. You should always keep at it, because inspiration is not something that just strikes in the middle of the night and then you're going to write the best song. No, you're writing the best song because you wrote 10 bad songs.
Yeah.
So it's like Leonard Cohen says, you know, he said something like, if I knew the place where good songwriting came, I would go there more often, you know.
Absolutely.
It's just it's just never give up, really. And things come, but they, you have to trick yourself, change your habits. It's the same way you would do, you know, you would train your body, you know, to gain muscles. It's the same way. You have to train yourself to write. And also, I think something I've realized is you shouldn't be afraid to copy the people you admire. And I mean that not in a bad way. I just mean that everything you write in your notebook, nobody has to read it, you know. So don't censor yourself. If you feel like, oh, I love this line from this poet, write it down and play with those words, and just don't have too many rules, or break them, or invent new rules, but try to, yeah, be versatile, I think.
This Must Be the Gig is produced by Adam Kivel. We'd like to thank Dean Berger and Daniel Brater for additional music, as well as the Consequence Podcast Network. Hey! If you've listened this far, why not go the extra mile and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you find your podcasts? Your comments provide valuable feedback for us, and it helps other people find us too. For information on new episodes, be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram at TMBTGpod. And generally, just irritate everyone you know about the show. Thanks again, and I miss you already.
Consequence Podcast Network.